I spread a song so you can sing along with my special guest star
two.
You like to sing and dance, and this podcast by chance explores musicals for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Life's But a Song, a podcast that likes to live in the land of musicals. I'm your host, John, and with me today, closing out the trilogy, is Aaron Marsh. Woo!
Hey, everybody. Let's get into some magic flute land.
Oh, my goodness. We
back
we
to set magic out, flute.
We set out to do a series of episodes, and we've gone all over the place with them. How are you?
I'm great. I'm starting a new job tomorrow.
Huzzah! And
I loved my last job, but you know, new challenges.
Much like this movie, which is the 2006 wow. version of The Magic Flute. The screenplay is by Kenneth Branagh and Stephen Fry. Music by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The English libretto is by Stephen Fry. Directed by Kenneth Branagh. And according to IMDb, during World War One. In an unnamed country, a soldier named Tamino is sent by the Queen of the Night to rescue her daughter, Pamina, from the clutches of the supposedly evil Sarastro, but all is not as it seems.
That's a good description. Sharps and flats.
No. We're going to draw this out.
Good. Let's actually start with all of that. Kenneth Branagh.
Okay. So this is apparently one of five films that he has not cast himself in. And I am so happy. There's one movie that I'm waiting to do on this podcast that I won't say I'll tell you the name.
Oh, I know it. I mean, yeah. if it's the musical he directed.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know it.
Yeah, that it's like, why are you in this? But in this
honestly,
one, I was
why
just...
are half of those people in that? I love it, but...
But with this one, it's like, I'm glad you didn't have the balls to cast yourself in this, because you're not an opera singer. You're an actor. You're not a singer either. You're an actor. So, but I was like, what part would he cast himself in? Tamino? Would he cast himself as Tamino or Papageno?
Yeah, good question. I feel like he'd... Papageno is like the character everybody loves, but I think he's so egotistical that he would have to cast himself as the romantic lead.
But I feel like Papageno has more screen time and singing.
Definitely. Especially in this version, yeah.
Okay. World War One.
It seemed like every time I look back, we're in another Papageno dream sequence.
So this is my question though to you is, do you? And I'm going to be making a reference to another podcast called "How Did This Get Made?"
Love it.
Think this is Tamino's Jacob's Ladder scenario?
Oh, that is a great question.
Because in the overture, we go through the barracks, right?
Yeah.
We're following a country. I don't know who's supposed to be what country in this. Tell you it's unnamed, but like there's the blue team and the red team. So we're in the blue team's barracks, and Tamino comes across a bomb and gets blown up, and then all of a sudden the three ladies come flying out from the heavens, and I was just like, let's fucking go. I mean, we also meet the snake monster, quote unquote, which is the smoke monster, which I was like
the gas, like, because the gas from World War One, it was the first one. I loved that whole first 20 minutes 30 minutes of the movie.
But then I was just like, is he dead? And this is his last dying dreams or dying visions or something?
Honestly, that makes a lot more sense of the film and answers one of the questions that I was going to bring up, but just really like, what is happening? But because, because he said after when he comes back, when he comes back to consciousness, he gets knocked out, like you said. When he comes back to, he's like, where am I? What is this place?
Yes.
So it's it we're led to believe that he does not wake up in the same reality that he was in before he lost consciousness. But then it never has the whole Wizard of Oz, I come back, and oh, you were there too, Papageno.
But because that's not in the... my memory of the... This is now the third time we've talked about the Magic Flute opera.
So now that you've seen a few film adaptions, I think you get why during our last episode, I kept saying how like, so this isn't really that faithful to the libretto, but this is the most faithful representation of the Magic Flute we are going to get on screen. This is so traditional.
Right. Because we had the 2022 one where we were going to Magic Flute Land.
Yeah.
That wasn't crazy enough.
Right.
And then we had the Ingmar Bergman one, which was too trippy, but not crazy enough as well. And then
it's also sort of like a stage production, that version. Yeah.
And then this one, the Ingmar Bergman one I was reading is the first one captured on film, but it was for television.
Correct.
This one, the Kenneth Branagh one, is the first one to be released in theaters with the intention to be released in theaters.
Why? Right. And what's really unusual with this one too, is it was filmed in like, I mean, you probably know this better, but I remember it was like 2006 or 2009 or something like that, but it never came out in the US for like 6 or 7 years.
I was just reading about trailers for it.
And I kept being like, oh my God, what is this film? I need to see this film. And then finally, many years later, it like silently dropped on DVD and turned out like, maybe I shouldn't have been holding my breath for it. But
so it was released in 2006 in Europe. Then in 2013, it was released in theaters in the US and then afterwards a DVD release as well.
And I wonder if the theatrical release in the US was super limited. I want to say I heard it was only like 2 nights, which makes me wonder if it was one of those like Fathom Events type releases.
Probably. Or it was at a festival somewhere and they're like, right, it was released in the US.
Ah. It did go to streaming a few years after the DVD release and was really heavy on streaming really up until now. But most recently, I didn't come across it on any platform, but I did find it on YouTube. I have the DVD, but strangely, the DVD doesn't have subtitles, so the YouTube version is kind of nice because of the captions.
I don't trust YouTube with captions.
Yeah, they can be very AI incorrect.
So I was a lot of this. I was just like, "What is happening?" So okay, we watched it. We had that first one, which was semi faithful translation.
Yeah, the translations were very good. It's just, it was such, like, there were only small sections of the opera in the film, right?
Right. And then in the Ingmar Bergman one, I believe they actually, they sang that in Swedish?
Like Swedish, yeah.
They sang that in Swedish, but we had the English translations. Do you, to your knowledge of the show, is this version a good translation?
Relatively. So it is a new libretto by Stephen Fry, which is, that's amazing. Stephen Fry, you know, besides his film work, he actually has books about mythology. He has like his Greek mythology book. I believe he came out with another one, maybe Norse mythology, but so he would be very steeped in the type of themes that this quote unquote plot is about. However, it's kind of disappointing knowing that Stephen Fry wrote this, and it's, you know, it's still not a great, again, quote unquote plot. It's rather faithful to the sequence of events and overall themes of the staged opera. But the words are not always faithful translations. And I think that's fine. Some interesting things about this, you know, so we were talking about Kenneth Branagh. This was not a film that he had any specific desire to make. This is not a passion project, which the other two films were. So the first film is like that Roland Emmerich produced one for a young director,
right?
Who it was his idea. He was like, why aren't we making this cool fantasy version of the magic flute on film? And, you know, whatever, it was fine. The second,
but then also the boarding school aspect where you're like, why?
Right. Why didn't you just make the magic flute then?
Right.
And then we watched Ingmar Bergman's, and we talked about how it was inspired by his, and his daughter and his childhood love of like that specific theater and that opera, et cetera. So that sounds like a passion project to me. This one came about because there is a group called the Peter Moores Foundation, which Peter Moores has since passed. And the Peter Moores Foundation has actually concluded their work in opera, as far as I understand. But he was a British aristocrat, meow, and a huge philanthropist in the arts, specifically opera. Which includes like all forms of supporting opera there. But one of the things that they did was they had a series of audio recordings called Opera in English, which were released by the classical recording label Chandos. And so there's a number of CDs and streaming recordings that you can listen to of famous operas sung in English. They're pretty good. And then towards the end of this project that they've now completed, they hired Kenneth Branagh to make an opera in English film, which was The Magic Flute. He wasn't familiar with the piece, and he's not necessarily, as far as I know, a fan of opera even. And I kind of feel like we need to know that a little bit about this version, that this isn't something that he was really familiar with or had like, I've got this idea, right? You know, it's like, well, he was just doing a job.
There are moments in this that, again, I don't remember. I don't remember past episodes. Once we record, it's gone from my memory.
Sure.
So there's some moments in this that I was just like, is this, did they add this? Is this actually part of the show? Like at the end when, the queen, Monastitos, and the three ladies are climbing the wall. Is that in the opera?
I don't remember that. No, that is in the opera. And that was one of the things I think Ariana and I were saying we missed from the other production, the other film, was that they cut that. They do their like last attempt at a coup. And it's always staged in different ways. Like, but ideally what is happening is Sir Ostra, who is the priest of the sun, finally blasts her with light like Godzilla, and she's defeated.
That's what happens in that first one we did, right? No.
Well, they just cut the scene. It's not really that obvious what happens to her from what I remember, but they definitely cut the last return of her with Monastitos.
I mean, it was interesting to watch this to watch that scene, because it felt like she sacrificed herself. It wasn't that he blasts her with light as you suggest.
Right.
He tries to save her.
Right. And she refuses.
Which is interesting, because I know we've had this conversation in either both episodes or one of them, where this movie, I think, definitively states that Sarastro is Pamina's father.
Yes. And Bergman did the same thing, which, again, that's not in the libretto, but it's a fine interpretation. But yeah, this one explicitly shows
you see the flashback.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he's singing,
which makes it, I don't know, how does that make you feel about his character?
So in this version of it, I will only speak to this version of it, because again, I black out the other ones. In this version of it, he doesn't seem, and I think I said this even in the first time or in all of them, like, he doesn't seem villainous. Like, we have Monastitos, who also in this version doesn't seem as like creepy rapey as he should be or was in the other ones.
Yeah, we'll get to him.
But Sarastro in this one seems like Jesus.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they're okay with the World War One concept. He's on the red team, and I don't know what else to call them besides teams.
Sure.
And they all wear the red uniforms. He has the hospital for the villagers. I'm assuming that's who the chorus is.
Yeah.
Or like people, just people
refugees.
And he's in charge of the red team, I'm assuming, because he has the two guards that are with him that are all in their red uniform. And right.
he demotes Monocytos at some point.
He demotes it. And then also for the last two trials, Tamino has to wear the red uniform.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, there was a moment before the second trial actually, quote unquote, started, because my God, this movie blasted through the last two trials really fast.
Thank goodness.
There's a moment where I was just like, are they saying that the trial of fire and water is happening because he has to fire a gun and it's raining?
Why not?
I was close. I was close. The trial of fire is him and Pamina walking through a firefight. You know,
it's almost as good as Wonder Woman.
And then they have to, and then they, the trial by water, at least in the first one, the trial by water was very impressively done. The one in the 20 in 2022.
You know, I don't even remember.
I remember it was
whole
underwater scene
yes.
and everything. And yeah. It was a little more complex. This one, there's
say my name, Bastion. That's right.
Yeah. Yes, basically. And this one, it's just they get sucked up in a flood of water in the barracks.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the trial.
Yeah. How did they know that was gonna happen?
Also,
how did they know that was gonna happen?
I know this is an opera, but for whatever reason, in this one, characters just jump to hanging themselves.
Yes.
Too much. Yeah. Like, Pamina, during the first trial, runs away, and it made me think, I was just like, dude, we're in World War One. You could, and you're fucking with the whole story anyway. Like, I don't know what is actually real or what is going on. Write out that you can't talk to her right now. They said you can't talk. They didn't say you can't write. That was, and then she was like, no, but I'm gonna go hang myself because he doesn't talk to me. It's like, okay, also lady, you just met him, so I know this is opera, but my God.
But if he doesn't love me,
but if he doesn't love me, I'm going to go hang myself.
Emotional vampire. I mentioned, I do love the whole like first 30 minutes or 20 minutes of this. It seems like just something about the image quality that the overture sets up already has that surrealistic feel. Like it just begins in an image of the sun in the sky, but I don't know, like, immediately you kind of get where he's going with this, that it's going to be surreal imagery the whole time. And I love that.
Well, so when it ends, when the overture ends and there's the army band.
I love that. Instead of like, a marching band.
I was like, let's fucking go.
It's like a marching
go.
Symphony. Yeah. That was one thing I wrote down.
But then again, I think Tamino dies. And this
I
is
think
his
you're right.
Dying visions. Because people just start flying. The three ladies fly in as nurses, horny nurses.
With cleavage. So there's very few things I know about World War One, I'm going to be quite honest. But I appreciated, one of the reasons I really like this opening section so much is because, like, the main folklore stories I've heard of World War One are all included, pretty much. So we have... It's too clean. I do want to say with that, and I probably would flag
that.
But
it's a Kenneth Branagh movie, so
right. So everything's pretty. You know, the barracks aren't. They do show one rat, but it's not mountains of rats and pieces of men's bodies, and they're not starving. Which, if you look up images from World War One, that is what you see.
Yes, but the sandbags turn into faces at one point. So
that it was amazing. So
that was. insane. Because at first, that was amazing. When it zooms out and you just see eyes, and then all of a sudden the sandbag starts singing, I lost my mind. I think this movie.
That was actually when my mom said, "Oh, I'm going to watch this."
I'm sorry to jump on your point, but I feel like this movie has the blend of like the what was missing from the other ones that we watched, where this is crazy. It could be crazier.
It could be crazier, right?
But it's still crazy enough. I'm satiated, but I could I have a little bit more. You know, it's not like the first one where we're like, just do Magic Flute Land, fuck the boarding school. Yeah. Like, that's what we want to see. I want to see that giant snake. I want to see all the batshit crazy stuff that's going on. In this one, when they're like, ghost children. or the three ladies have so many costumes.
Yeah. So there were stories in World War One about like protective goddess figures that would show up to soldiers on the battlefront. And
okay,
it feeds a little bit into that scene I reference in Wonder Woman. It might be in the French soldiers, like, or in France, the image of the Blessed Virgin or something like that. Or sometimes it was an otherworldly nurse. And I think that's actually where he's going with when the three ladies fly down as nurses. And
but then people start flying later on and you're like, oh,
yeah, people so start flying later on. And then they have so the Queen of the Night always has to bestow the titular magic flute on the Tamino, and it's always given via the three ladies. But in this, it's given as a Christmas present, which was really cute because they portray that again, that folkloric historical, I guess, time when the soldiers on each side of the battle called a truce on Christmas Eve and played football together. And so we see that happen.
Explains that whole scene. Cause all of a sudden I was just like,
it's Christmas
snowing and you're now hugging each other.
Yeah. That's a really famous piece of World War One. Yeah. Because they were, you know, they were people, they didn't necessarily, you know, soldiers were pawns. We are pawns, you know, of the powerful elites. Right. So yeah, I thought, which it, I guess I thought goes that was with clever that he did that.
Which I guess goes with the Masonic imagery. And themes of this, because I mean it took a while for me to pick up on some of the Masonic things, but I don't think they actually had it because I think they were too focused on it being World War One. It wasn't until at one point the chorus like moves the scaffolding around in Sarastro's palace that I was like, ah, here we go. Here's the Masonic,
that, like,
here's
Temple everything. Of the Sun imagery all of a sudden. That's beautiful. It's strange because there's some really beautiful imagery in this film. And I will say it's probably the most beautiful film of the Magic Flute, although again, not traditional. But then there's actually parts of it that are pretty cold looking or, you know, less than interesting looking. So it kind of goes back and forth.
There's that moment where Papageno. So the backstory for the audience, for the listening audience, I could not find a track list of this, and I know it's Magic Flute, but you know, things are going to be cut, things are going to be moving around because it's also a movie, and that's what inevitably happens. And I believe that happened with the 2022 one where some things were moved or definitely cut. So I'm going to be just describing the song that happened, the arias that happened, but I don't know what they called it because there is a CD I saw, but the internet doesn't have it. And it
interesting. I've never even seen the audio recording of this. And strangely, they reportedly did sing on set instead of to playback, which kind of explains that initially when I was rewatching for this, I wanted to make a comment about some of the weird audio quality and some of their voices. But then when I heard that, I said, oh, that's why.
Well, also they cast opera singers.
They cast opera singers. They cast and some famous and some unknown opera singers. It's a good mix.
They cast hot opera singers.
Yes. That's Sarastro why some of them are known.
Is hot.
Sarastro was probably the most famous bass of that time. So he was huge and he's amazing.
And very attractive.
Yeah. Yeah. Monocytos is attractive.
Okay. We're here. Monocytos.
Yeah, Monocytos. So he was like, as we've seen from these three films, it's almost as if nobody knows what to do with that character, right?
And we've talked a lot about him where I believe, is this the one that follows the original text? Because he talks about the color of his skin.
He does say that, right. And that is accurate. So sometimes he's portrayed in, you know, in some productions, he's portrayed like monstrous because he's a villain figure in the plot. So sometimes he's portrayed as monstrous. Sometimes like we watched Ingmar Bergman where he was basically like a vindictive, a jester, I think he said it was, his costume was like a court jester.
Yes.
For, you know, if you're scared of clowns, that makes sense. But for the people who are scared of clowns, he's an attractive man.
He's a sexy soldier who happens to be not one of the like three not white people in this movie.
Right. And it's that also, it brings up questions.
which to me, this one, because they kept that line, or at least, you know, the English translation that they had him talking about his skin color. I was just like, oh, I guess we are talking about racism in this.
And I think part of that is Brana. And Stephen Fry, right. The singer who portrays him, he's still working in opera. I actually think he's one of the better like actors for film in this movie, even though he's not a film actor. He's really good in it. But yeah, I think Kenneth Branagh had this idea to reinterpret him as a cross between Othello and Iago at the same time, right? So he's, you know, I mean, he's just a very human figure, which I guess that goes along with the setting since it's semi now historically. He's
also, I feel like the one in the 2022 version was very predatory.
Yeah.
And in this one, he's not, which I appreciated. It just felt like he's just another messy human who happens to not do good things, you know?
I mean,
like,
he's really messy, though.
really messy. He breaks fucking mirrors in his aria. He's so messy. He bashes his head through a mirror. And that's not the craziest thing that happens in this movie.
We do get a near nude shot of him, though, so.
Whatever. Yeah.
Sharps to that.
Right. when he's wearing the jock strap or whatever.
Yeah.
There's that moment to go back to what I was started.
Yes. Yes.
My setup. There's that moment where Papageno saves Pamina and the two of them are just belting on the roof of the castle.
Right.
And it's like, move. I get it. Where this movie, I think, wanted to have it all, but I don't think it should have. Because like it was like we're paying homage to the opera, but we're also a movie. But look, flying women everywhere, and
well,
you're
she's
like
the queen of the night.
Not just her. The flashback scene the daydream that Papageno has that I feel like filming that scene must have been terrible for those women, because they would float in and you're like, you know, because he flies in first and you know those six women are above the camera sight line just hanging out waiting to fly in, so this must have been so uncomfortable for them to then all of a sudden be like, oh, I'm supposed to be angelic and land and be sexy and ooh, pick me as your wife or whatever's happening in that moment.
And their Peter Pan harness.
And their Peter Pan harness that, like...
Real sexy.
That, like, if anyone has ever worn a harness or, you know, work with actors wearing harnesses, they're not comfortable. No. Yes, they're very safe, or they're safe because, you know, you've got the wires to connect to you or something. Because, unfortunately, humans can't fly. It just is like all up in your business. And you, and I was like, this is, I wish, you know, I was there on that day of filming so I can hear them be like, I'm hating everything. Give me my money.
Calculating how much you're getting paid by the minute that you're on the harness.
Yes. But I feel like this movie, like, pay too much homage to the stage work in opera, because obviously, like I said, the Papageno Pavina duet hits differently when it's on stage than in a movie. Where, like, I mean, I didn't recognize that they captured the singing live. I thought they were all lip syncing, and so you could be running around, you know.
Sure.
It's a movie. Like, there are moments where they're like, it's a movie, so we're flying and they're climbing the side of the castle, free climbing it, or, you know, like, we're jumping around in the barracks in that one scene with
I actually really like that scene.
but then it's like, oh, well, now we're also in opera, and so we're just going to waste time belting our faces off while everything else is happening around us. And it just felt so jarring. And thank you for saying earlier that this was not a passion project for Kenneth Branagh, because now it makes sense.
Yeah.
Why these disjointed moments happen.
Yeah. I think he did a fine job, fine enough, but he was definitely getting a paycheck. You know, it was that kind of job. And I'm glad there's something that always bothers me about that rooftop scene. And I think one reason, because it's one of those that borders on the, it's almost pretty, but it's just not composed well enough to be that compelling and visually. And then, they're supposed to be fleeing Monocytos, who wants to kill them. And instead they sit on the roof and dangle their feet and sing for 10 minutes.
Meanwhile, then, and giving
and how
them
are they
going to
get
time,
off the roof?
Giving them ample time for Monocytos and or his men to find them, climb up to the tower that they are, and then, you know, get to the magic bells moment. I had a moment at the end of the opera, at the end of the movie, by the way.
Can we recut that scene to Vogue?
Well, no, because it's funny when the other soldiers just jump from that part of the roof to another part of the roof in rhythm. that was funny. I wish the dance was more of like a dance.
Yeah.
But like, the jumping happened. But my mind wandered at the end, at the very end. Do you think Andrew Lloyd Webber was inspired by this to write when he wrote Cats?
Oh my God.
There's a moment that happens during the fanfare that it felt like the opening number of Cats, where they're like, na, 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 na. I don't know the words, but that part. And I was like, oh, this sounds like it. And I know Andrew Lloyd Webber likes to borrow.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
So anyway, that was just my thought that I had.
If you're going to steal from the best.
Right.
Can we talk about the Queen of the Night?
Okay. I hated her costume. I'm not going to lie. It's like you have her riding in on a tank. Yes. As her grand entrance, but her costume isn't as grand as that entrance.
No, she needed like a metal bustier and everything.
She needed to be the stereotypical opera singer image that it happens in like the Looney Tunes cartoons.
Totally.
She needs to be Brunhilde, basically.
Totally.
Like, I know we're comparing to the other two, but we're doing a saga, everyone. Like, mm-hmm. the Queen of the Night in the 2022 one, where she starts flying during her so moment. Good. Like, that's amazing. The flying that the Queen does in this movie is also cool. But, like, Kenneth Branagh...
It's very Harry Potter 2006.
But Kenneth Branagh decided also to focus on her mouth.
Oh, my God.
Weird moments. Like, there's that one shot... in her first aria, yep. that it's the mouth in the foreground in profile, and mm-hmm. it looks like she's eating the set.
Yeah, and the, like, and more tanks are like coming from her mouth, sort of.
Like, and... I know I say like, you know, an actor chooses the scenery or something, but I'm like, why is she literally eating the set? I don't understand this.
Yeah, he really had no idea what to do sometimes when characters just. Either repeat a line or sing non-verbally like the Queen of the Night does. I think it's really apparent he really just needed to fill time sometimes.
It was just so weird.
Yeah, it is weird. And we've had that, we've talked how the plot gives you that unexpected twist, which is really great, actually, considering, you know, how old this work is, but we're led to believe in the beginning that the Queen of the Night is like the damsel in distress figure or the good mother figure. And then halfway through the opera, it gets twisted and we find out she's a villain. But in this, I mean, she comes in, as you said, riding on a tank.
And which so... I'm here for. I was here for that. I didn't. I mean, I totally forgot that she's supposed to be a little more demure in her entrance, but I was like, power bitch moment.
Yeah.
I want more, but I wanted more.
But
like
it needed
leather,
to be more. I agree. It needed
or
to
like
be more.
A giant collar. Her hair was doing nothing.
No,
for
it's
this.
Like in a braid or something.
She's great. I will
yeah,
say that
she's fine.
Let me say her name, you know, cause give her some respect. Hold on. Let me find her. Lyubov Petrova,
yeah,
going with it. She was great. Everyone was great in this, talent wise. It's just that the choices made around them
mm-hmm.
didn't make sense mm-hmm. at some points. Like I'm all for art being a living thing. So set it on the, like, I really wish I saw that production of La Boheme that was set on the moon. It sounds wild. They have a spacesuit in it. I think they jumped around as if they had zero, like, moon gravity, but I'm here for it. You're doing a strong choice. It could be strong and wrong. It could be strong and right. This had the potential to be something. And they did the things because they followed the fantasy of mm-hmm. the opera that we've complained about in the other ones or discussed further. It's just that there are some moments with this specific concept that I don't think helped the movie.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the main points I wanted to get at as well.
Like the sandbag moment, amazing.
Right.
And then you the camera turns away and it goes back and they're just sandbags. They're not faces. Yeah. Great. I don't mind the fact that it is set during a war because that helps later on
mm-hmm.
when it's the Queen of the Night versus Sarastro. And I'm assuming Queen of the Night is the blue team. Like she is.
Yeah, right. Right.
She's them. But there's some other moments where I'm just like, oh God, this isn't, you're not helping.
No, it doesn't always help. And I think that's exactly the problem with setting it in a specific time period, like World War I. And it did give us a lot of moments, but it didn't actually bring I don't, in my opinion, it didn't actually bring any new understanding or increased clarity to the story, which is what setting it in a concept should do. I mean, if you're right. going to take something and introduce a new concept, it should be because you're bringing out specific aspects of the story or helping us understand it in our modern times in a different way. And I don't think it really succeeded at that. I think it was cool, but I think it actually brings more questions and more like enigmas and even more plot holes than if it had not been done.
Because I'm not going to lie, my mind did wander. And my attention did wander a lot during this. So sometimes same. I'm like, what's happening here? Mm-hmm. I didn't hear how they justified that Tamino wasn't the one saving Pamina.
He sent Papageno first to clear the way, basically. She asks him, you know, like, why didn't he come to myself? And he just says something like, oh, he sent me, you know, he sent me first to make the way or whatever. You know, it's just one like line of dialogue. That's basically like all of it. It kind of needed to be bigger. There's things where I was curious what you thought about the mouth. I was curious what you thought about her flying and her second aria. Her acting in the second aria, the revenge aria, is I think really good. I think that's commendable. And the English translation for that is great. She tells the daughter that she's going to forsake her, and she ends with saying, you've received your mother's curse, and then she flies away. And I think she just
started flying.
Again, very Harry Potter 2006 flying, you know, where they're sort of flailing about in the sky. Cartoon flailing about in the sky, but that's not her fault. I think she does a really good job, but it brings in this problem too with, okay, so is this surrealism, is this magical realism, is this just supposed to be realism? Because what is she, just a human? Is she a goddess, a queen of the night? Like, it's not really clear.
Is this a dream?
Is this a dream? You bringing up the fact that this actually could be his Jacob's ladder reaching salvation towards the end makes all of that make a lot more sense then, because then it doesn't matter as much.
Right, because the overture, although yes, it ends with them with the band and everything, and they're presumably playing the whole overture, is a little weird, but it's still very grounded because. Yeah. You know, war is weird. Or when you read about, when you look at the reenactors where they're like, the drummer is crossing the battlefield with the front line. And you're like, why is this happening? why do you need beats to to shoot the enemy or something? But it then went off the rails with the smoke snake.
Yeah.
And then the three ladies flying in, which I guess we're going with the imagery, but still the fact that they used flying a lot in this movie.
They do. Yeah, they do.
And then Papageno's daydream ends with giant lips. Like the shitty CGI lips.
Mm-hmm.
What is,
it should have been a giant butt. Sir Mix-a-Lot style.
I feel like Kenneth Branagh, like, there's some moments where he liked it and some moments where he didn't like it, so he kind of gave up, but like, still you're like, dude, you gotta go in.
I also feel like he's like, well, I got all this money from Peter Moores, I have to spend it somehow.
it should be known that this is part of Mozart's 250th birthday anniversary celebration.
Oh, amazing.
So there's a whole reasoning behind this. And then that foundation that you said did a recording, an audio recording of it.
Yes, I have
with
that.
With a different cast.
Correct.
And then they did this one.
And it's a different translation. It is similar, but it's not Stephen Fry, from what I remember.
Well, because I guess Stephen Fry and Kenneth Branagh were like, let's make this Let's make this World War One, and we're gonna have some fun.
And we keep tossing Brenner around. He's known, of course, for adapting Shakespeare for film. And I understand why then maybe they would have thought he was the right hire for this job. But then the music is brilliant in The Magic Flute, but he's not just adapting Mozart. He's adapting the libretto, which is not Shakespeare, you know, let's be honest. And so he's using kind of his usual tricks that he does for adapting Shakespeare, like let's make it lush and let's make it overtly romantic and we'll reset it in another time period. But I don't know that it works for this piece. And I like the film. I have to say, I like the film. And yeah. I did say it did create a lot of really beautiful imagery. Overall, it's kind of like a what the fuck just happened, though, by the time you reach the end of the movie.
Which I'm here for, because that's what the opera is.
It is.
The opera is so fantastical that you're like,
yeah, yeah.
If you're not asking yourself, what the fuck did I just watch?
Why are we even watching?
Why are we even watching? Do you think that this needed to be over 2 hours long?
It could have had some more cuts. I think they were trying to be somewhat purists in that sense. And we don't know what, you know, we don't know what criteria he was given, right?
True.
So I think that plays into it, even with the casting and all of that.
Now, in this version, was there something that was cut that you wish that they put in?
Not that I can recall. It's, you know, like you said, my mind wanders a bit watching this too. There's some scenes that go on a bit too long. What I would talk about are the English adaptions. So, as you mentioned, a lot of the Masonic elements are taken out, which is, you know, which is fine. But including that as like Sarastro overtly sings in the libretto about Isis and Osiris, the gods of Egypt. And he has actual prayers. And here he might say things like, great spirits of peace, or all who enter this place, things like that. So it makes it more universal, and it does help open it up to, you know, the broader timeline. But I don't think it necessarily helps in clarity, because the words become more generalized.
Because, like, I'm assuming they took the original German version of it, and that's mm-hmm. what they translated and cut and everything. Because the Met production that's in English is only like an hour and 45 minutes. So,
see, we should have filmed that one.
Make it snappy, boys. Figure it out.
But, you know, and it's not that I mean I would want to sit for the full production of Die Zauberflot. You know, I'm not trying to downgrade the opera, but we know film is a different medium, right? And you can tell things in film that you can't on stage just visually. We don't need to hear it all. Again, the libretto is not Shakespeare. Other people will totally disagree with this. I mean, there are, you know, Mozart is a genius. We might want to hear every note he wrote. That's fine. But yeah, in my opinion, film is a different medium.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we get into Sharp and Flat?
I think I'm hip for Sharp and Flats.
Great. Let's do it.
Sharp Flat.
So in this section, we're going to highlight some moments, whether or not we talked about it. If we liked it, it's sharp. And if we didn't like it or thought it could change, it's flat. I want to start instead with my natural, because I had a natural for this.
Okay.
So every once in a while, I have what I like to call a natural. It's neither a sharp nor a flat. In this case, it's actually both. And it's the concept.
Yeah, I was actually going to sharp and flat it. And I probably still will, but go ahead.
Yeah, but you're also naturaling it. Because like we said, there's moments where it looked cool. It was great. I liked the costuming for the most part. I liked the fact that, you know, it's a little more relatable for my knowledge and everything. But like, there are things that still could have gone further. There are things that, like I said, they didn't do well or not do well. There's things that like didn't help this retelling of it. And it sounds like you have the same idea behind it.
Yeah. I would flat it, I think, because as I already mentioned, you know, I don't think it helped bring clarity to it. I think it was a bit of, I almost think it was like a bit of
like a cop out in a way where it's like, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know what to do with this. Set it in World War One. We'll figure it out.
Almost like too egotistical in a sense of Brana. But, and so I don't think it works overall. I do think it gave us a different film and a very, at some points, beautiful and interesting film. And I also want to sharp that because of those aspects. And, you know, you have to reach high, right? They shot for something. So
you're right.
You know, do that. Shoot for something. I do like that.
You don't score on the shots you don't make, you know?
right. They tried. I do like that.
Let's do flats then.
Yeah.
So my first flat is watching this on YouTube with the commercials, because it would happen at the wrong times all the time. I'm not paying for YouTube, so it's my own problem. But like all of a sudden in the middle of an aria, I'd get a commercial for Kamala and for Kamala asking for money.
Totally. And Tim not Walls. Today, not tomorrow.
Right now.
Plus, now you went from like a 2 hour and 12 minute movie to what, like a 3 hour movie, probably.
I mean, it wasn't bad because I always skipped it after the 5 second mark. I also flatted the Queen's costume. It's not, like I said, it's not crazy enough. I needed something. We needed armor. We needed the giant collar. We needed like crazy makeup. We need something.
Yeah.
Because like at this point, we all know that the Queen of the Night is the villain.
Mm-hmm.
Even in her first entrance, you know she's the villain. Because
they didn't waste any time.
Yeah. I am also, we didn't talk about this, but I'm also flatting the flute being a basic design. It was like a tube, you know, like the flute in the 2022 one was very ornate in it. And even in the Ingmar Bergman one, it was a little more decorative and ornate and gold. This is just like a piece of wood that, like a twig that they whittled.
How funny is it too that no one actually plays the flute? He just holds it in his hand.
He holds it up and all of a sudden it starts playing and the chorus starts dancing around him. And I was just like, what? I thought he's supposed to play it. And then my last flat is for the close-up shots. There's like the mouths. There's moments in other arias that it's just really close up on the faces, and I was not having it. Mm-hmm. Like in the Queen of the Night aria, the aria, when she starts singing like the flute, it's like a close up shot of her face and like a little shaky camera. I was like, we didn't make those.
That's right. It's like it's one of those weird angle shots as well. Yeah,
where like you said, he had no idea what to do. When right. they're just singing like onomatopoeia or just ah. What were your flats?
So the flat for the concept that we've already gotten for setting it in World War One, I would flat Pamina. I don't remember her name as a singer. I feel horrible doing that. I don't really want to draw people out. But yeah, I don't think she was right. I don't think she sounded right for the role.
Her name is Amy Carson.
Sorry, Amy Carson. Yeah, I really didn't enjoy her sound in this. And I would flat the Queen's hair specifically. She's just kind of mousy.
It's just boring. Yeah,
she's just kind of mousy.
This is the Queen of the Night. This is like one of the biggest villains in opera.
Right.
Right, we'll call her a villain.
Yeah, she's a villain. She's the villain.
And like one of, she has the most known aria in all of opera. I'm sorry to say that, but this is the one that's used a lot in other media to be like, you're listening to opera, Queen of the Night aria. It's 9 times out of 10.
And specifically then, like you mentioned, the mouth shots. But what I would flat is the fact that, I mean, Brana should know this. Again, he adapts Shakespeare. Finding a reason, whatever it is, for those scenes, for those nonverbal scenes, for just the beauty of the voice to happen. Is she laughing at, you know, is she cackling like a wicked witch? Is she just so in love with herself that she's enjoying the beauty of her singing? I mean, even that is a choice, right? But we didn't really get any of that. We just got, okay, let's watch the way her mouth moves while she makes these sounds. And we've seen other films, we've seen, you know, recordings of stage productions where the actresses do make those. There's the, you know, everybody, a lot of people replay this Deanna Domro recording of her. But in that one, I like that she's almost a bird of prey. Right. And so then that those sounds become like her attack call. There's just so many any ways you that you can take this.
Get a concept. Let's go.
Yeah. And yeah, they really took an easy way out on that without a concept. There's scenes in what I guess we're calling the hospital that it's like it wants to be Hogwarts, but it just does not look that, it doesn't look that real and lived in, which really surprises me. It's so close, but it's not there. It comes off looking very, I said earlier, like cold. It's some sort of artificial. I mean, it looks like real stone, but it very much feels like a set. It doesn't feel like this is an actual old castle that they are inhabiting.
I mean, it was all filmed on a set. Everything was filmed on a set. Right. There was nothing, no outside shots.
Those are my flats. It's really not a lot considering.
Okay, sharps. My first sharp is for Kenneth Branagh not casting himself in this. Because I didn't want to see 2 hours and 15 minutes of him
flexing
being
muscles.
Egotistical blowhard like I have in other movies that he's directed. Hello, Poirot. I also am sharping that they cast hot singers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it felt like because I know opera these days, like they're casting like theater in a way where you want attractive people, not just they need the talent, but also they need, you know,
someone believable in the role. Yeah.
Well, no, not that. We want, you know, like very slender figures. And so that's what they did in this movie. But
I wouldn't mind seeing more of Tamino.
But I'm saying like they cast hot, like I know back in the day it was anybody was cast and usually people who are larger sizes would probably be Placido Domingo,
that was the
for
norm.
Example.
That's the norm. Yeah.
Yeah. I also sharped the queen riding the tank because I fucking love that. In a movie with some insane choices, that was the craziest one and I was ready for it.
There is something I forgot to mention. There was a few times in this movie where I don't know that I would sharp this, but where things just get so weird. So there's a scene where Pamina is tied to the wings of the windmill
as she's crucified.
Yes, and there's a few scenes like that, but that one specifically comes to mind where I thought to myself, okay, this film is him trying to be Ken Russell. Unfortunately, he's not Ken Russell. But could you imagine Ken Russell's magic flute?
Oh,
that's what we're missing.
Let's get him back from the dead and be like, Ken Russell, here's $10 million, figure it out. I also am sharping them using internal monologues as some of the arias because for me, watching opera, sometimes it's hard to distinct what's dialogue, what's internal monologue, what's actually singing.
Yeah.
We did Tales of Hoffman. You listened to that episode. I know you did. And there's that moment in the, oh, fuck, what's her name? Antonia's act where I'm like, what's song and what's dialogue. I'm also sharpening the tracking shots through the barracks. It happens a couple of times. I'm a sucker for long takes.
Yeah.
I love the opening is just a giant long take and I loved it. Mm-hmm. And then my last sharp is for playing into the fantasy of the opera. Like, they went there. Again, I said I could use, I have room for more, but they have a great, crazy bass.
Do we have room for Ken Russell, basically? We have,
oh my God.
He got close. He got close. He tried.
Sharps.
Sharps. Okay, we'll start with, I want to sharp the Marching Symphony, because it's not just a marching band. We get a whole marching symphony to play the overture for us. And it has a very surreal feel, composed like a surrealist painting. I love that, sort of like a minimalist surrealist painting. I love that. But I would actually extend that sharp to the whole first like 30 minutes. We get the barracks, we get introduced to the two sides of the war, we get mysterious healing three ladies, we get a rat, and it's like, and then when the soul, so I mentioned it was like too clean, it's too perfect, I guess that's sort of the surreality of it, but then as soon as they start marching, people are getting blown up. Like Tamino's singing and he's marching and the men next to him are literally exploding. And it's a pretty amazing scene.
We did see the little bit of like the effects of war.
Yes.
You know, where there's bodies everywhere. They still looked very like well placed and clean
and not starving.
But the dead bodies, I mean. Yeah. They still looked clean even though they're dead, you know. But yeah, we're seeing it.
I mean, there was carnage. Yeah, there was carnage. And then we get the Christmas tree. We get a small truce, a small example of brotherhood, of what is going to be achieved, like globally or nationally, at the end of the opera.
True.
So I really do think the first 30 minutes or so of this film are really well done.
Are they saying that the trials will lead to the end of World War One?
Yes. That is what they're saying.
Instead of, even though Tamino's there, he's like, I want this girl I met yesterday. And Sarastro's like, you're going to end World War One with these trials.
there is this way that I like to look at fairy tales on my podcast, the Storybook Witchcraft podcast. Sorry, my mouth's getting dry, I guess. Where we look at all of these figures as in taking place inside one person, right? And your Jacob's Ladder analogy really would apply that to this, again, quote unquote plot. But so the reason he falls in love with Pamina so quickly and the reason he has to unite with her at the end then is because she's the spiritual aspect of himself. She's like his higher soul. And so once he unites with her, he's now uniting those warring fractions of himself. Monocytos would be the more lustful feelings that he feels for her, as opposed to the spiritual union with her. And then
Sarastro is the do good Jesus
exactly
figure in him.
Exactly, you know. And so then he would, you know, when he's united, now he can transcend, he can basically go to heaven. I forgot why I went on that tangent
with a very shitty CGI statue.
Oh, because of ending World War One, right?
Yes.
So and yeah, you know, it wouldn't be the first war that was won by marrying off two people from each side. So that's how you do it.
Any other sharps?
Oh yeah. So I do want to sharp Monocytos. I think his acting was great, even though he's not even a film actor. He's an opera singer. I love those weird faces in the trenches. That's a really cool scene. Sharp that. And even the music in that scene, I don't know if it's like given a little bit of a quicker tempo or what, but it kept my interest. I think the idea of using the toxic war gas as the snake was a very clever choice. I'd like to sharp that. We need to sharp Renee Pop as Sarastro. I'm listening on like my shitty soundbar, and when he gets those low notes and the whole thing rumbles, it's still like glorious. He's amazing. Rene Papp. I'd also like to sharp the old woman who is Papagena in disguise. I think of the three versions that we've watched of this opera, this one handles that scene and that whole kind of like ongoing joke the best. I still don't think it completely, I still think I maybe have seen it better on stage, but she's really good. The old wench that comes and offers him beer or water.
Get it, and Liz then, Smith.
And then when she, that sort of reveal where she transforms into young Papagena.
That was a good editing moment.
That was a really nice piece of film magic. I didn't expect it coming, actually. Right. So
all of a sudden she turns around and she's young and I'm like, whoa.
And that's actually one of those scenes where the inside of the castle hospital, whatever, it's not that great. They've been in there for a little while, but then that was a really good effect. I think those are my sharps. I also do like that, although there was some very strong close-ups. You know, he's a film director. He knows what he's doing, I guess. There's a lot of mix between wide angles. It's not like some that we've seen where either the whole thing is shot wide and almost as if it's a stage production, or it relies too much on complete close-ups. You know, this did have a nice balance, I think.
I know I usually ask about Life's Playlist at this point, but out of the three we've done, which soundtrack are you more likely to listen to?
This one has a weird audio quality. I like that it's in English, but if I had this available on audio.
You had all three of them.
I might listen to this one. I do listen to the Peter Moore's recording of it sometimes, which is, you know, a different recording, but in English. If I had this one available as just audio,
but I'm not asking you
it.
About the other Peter Moore's recording.
No, but I might listen to this one. That's what I'm saying. I might listen to this one. Yeah.
I mean,
I didn't like Papagena. I might skip her.
I think out of all of them, I would agree with you to listen to this one, because like, as I know you and Ariana did not like Three Ladies in that one, like their tone, but I did, but I feel like this is the one where I'm like, oh, I understand why you don't like that.
I should have sharped their cleavage.
You can. You just did.
let's sharp the Three Ladies cleavage. It just like appears out of nowhere.
And there's something, I don't really remember the Ingmar Bergman like voices.
They were good.
Been so long.
Yeah, they were good.
They were good because they were also singers. But I think there's something about this one where, as you said about Rene Papp and Ben Davis, who played Papageno, and Joseph Kaiser, who played Tamino, like there's something about their voices that I was like, I like this. I would like to listen to this recording of it.
And though, you know, I wasn't able to understand everything that they sang, I think that understanding some of it just by, you know, just, you know, because we probably wouldn't be listening that intently, but you would still get the idea of what's going on.
I'm saying the melodic nature of their voices. I like.
Yeah. I mean, I liked that. I like the fact that it's in English. When we talked about the Ingmar Bergman, I was kind of like, you know, those singers, they were really good. I really enjoyed listening to them perform. But if I was going to listen to a recording, especially in another language, I'd probably listen to a German recording to hear how it's originally composed.
Oh, of course.
So then this one, for me, the idea would be that hearing these performances mixed with the fact that I can kind of follow along with the English, with the English libretto as well.
Well, Aaron, on that note, we did it.
We did it.
We did our saga. Wasteland. We did our saga of the Magic Flute. I will never do this again. Well, I wouldn't never say never, but like I need some time in between.
You've been getting pretty heavy into these opera films lately. Tales of Hoffman isn't even easy to find. So
I had it on DVD. I don't remember buying it.
I'm so jealous. Apparently Coppola made like a re-edit, a restoration, but it hasn't been released. Someday.
Okay.
Yeah, he like made his own version, his own cut of the film.
But Aaron, what do you have to plug or promote?
I have my series of discussions, which I slightly referred to as Storybook Witchcraft. You can find me on Instagram as Storybook Witchcraft or Storybook Podcast. We look at classic works of literature, fairy tales, and have a little roundtable discussion on some of the deeper meanings that are within. My most recent released episode at the time of recording was a folktale that a guest translated from Polish into English. It's the first time it's been discussed in an English language podcast called The Legend of Twardowski. And that was really exciting. So if these type of fantasy plots are your jam, I would suggest coming over and hearing talk about that. We have some coming up about Tolkien and other fairy tales.
I'm ready whenever you need me to be a guest on, I don't care what, but I'm ready.
I love it.
And out of the three we've done, you, the listening audience, what soundtrack would you listen to? I know this is not a cast recording. I'm calling it a soundtrack because it's a movie soundtrack. So, you can email me at buttersongpod@gmail.com. Also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok and Threads at buttersongpod. What did you say? What was the Instagram for a storybook again?
Storybook Witchcraft or Storybook Podcast. I think either show up.
So now you should all flood Aaron's DMs and say, get John on whatever episode. I'm ready.
I would love it. Yeah, I would love it.
And if you want to be part of the next episode's conversation, well, we're going to be talking about something very different. We're going to be discussing season one of High School Musical, the musical, the series.
If you're listening to this episode, I'm sure you will love that.
Yes, we go all over the place. Aaron, thank you so much for doing this
thank you for humoring me with this.
I think we have some stuff planned in the future. If not, we'll fix that.
We'll get together soon.
Yes. And everyone, thank you for listening and bye for now.
Special thanks to Aaron Troy for creating the pod's artwork and to Nick Bombacino for composing the theme song and the jingles. A huge thank you to CastBox for hosting this podcast. And thank you again for tuning in to today's episode of Life's But a Song. Bye for now, everyone, and have a musical day.